Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, the now 8-member U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on a contentious abortion case out of Texas on whether Texas regulations on abortion facilities are necessary or designed to impede women's access to abortion to impose an undue burden. We'll look at the case, the battle over the next Supreme Court nominee, and the docket awaiting the 8 justices. This hour on Point, Texas abortion and the post-Scalia Supreme Court. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you see the weight, the significance of the Texas abortion case? Are you feeling the weight of the decision on that next 9th justice? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, co-host of Slate's Political Gabfest. She is a fellow at Yale Law School. Emily Bazelon, welcome. Great to have you here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And with us from Stanford, California, is Jonathan Mitchell, visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution, visiting professor at Stanford Law School, former law clerk for Justice Antonin Scalia. And from 2010 to 2015, he was Solicitor General of the state of Texas. During that time, he represented Texas in the abortion case that was argued before the Supreme Court yesterday, as well as in two other cases on immigration and affirmative action that are now before the court. Jonathan Mitchell, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Emily, take us back. I mean, the basics here, 1973, Roe v. Wade recognizes a constitutional right to abortion. Plenty of controversy in the years since, but there it stands. 1992, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, also an enormous case, saying that you cannot place an undue burden on that right to an abortion. With that as the background, what is the heart of the case argued before the court yesterday, Emily?
The law in Texas creates basically two major new sets of regulations for abortion clinics. One says that they have to be equipped and outfitted like ambulatory surgical centers. So places people go to get outpatient surgery that have to have really wide hallways. You can wheel a gurney back and forth, cooling units, all the apparatus of a surgical center. And the second requirement says that doctors who perform abortions, that every clinic has to have one provider who has admitting privileges at a local hospital. And the big question in this case is whether these are rules that improve women's health and safety because they have a real medical justification, or whether they're really just a pretext for shutting down clinics because they're expensive or impossible to comply with. And one of the most striking parts of this case is that the American Medical Association and a bunch of other medical groups made a very forceful statement in the brief they filed to the Supreme Court saying that there were no medical justifications or real health and safety benefits, and indeed that these rules actually harm women by making it much harder to access abortion. And the prediction in this case is that if these laws go fully into effect, Texas will go from having had about 40 abortion clinics a few years ago to 10 or even 9 or 8. And then there are lots of other states that have similar regulations where clinics could also close.
So something like 23 other states already have this kind of regulation. Has there been a concerted effort to bring this style of legislation into states around the country, Emily?
Yes. The Americans United for Life, which is a legal organization in Washington, D.C., has a policy kind of model bill drafting shop, and they have what they call a women's protection project where they draft bills and then states pass those bills. And this has been a concerted effort to take the idea of protecting women's health as the justification for restricting abortion. And the kind of idea behind this is that really this is the closing of clinics is somehow just not the goal of the law, that really this is supposed to be a medically necessary law. And so the issue is, when you dig down into that claim, as the American Medical Association and other groups have done, is there really any basis for that? Or are we really just talking about shutting clinics, which, of course, from an anti-abortion point of view, is a worthy goal. It's just this question of whether they're doing what they say they're doing, or finding a pretext as a way of shutting down the clinics.
Jonathan Mitchell, here's your successor as Texas Solicitor General, Scott Keller, explaining yesterday outside the court what he saw as the basis for the Texas case.
This case is not about overturning Roe versus Wade. What this case, the issue in this case, is can Texas enact valid patient regulations that improve safety? And when over 210 women annually are hospitalized due to abortion, Texas can.
Here, of course, opponents on the other side of this say this is about shutting down abortion. Here's Amy Hagstrom Miller, lead plaintiff in this case, telling reporters the law is a thinly disguised effort by abortion foes.
This law is cruel and it is harsh, and it does nothing to advance medical health for women.
And here's Stephanie Tote, senior counsel for the Center for Reproductive Rights, argued the case before the court. She spoke to reporters afterwards, saying the law is about shutting down abortion clinics, not ensuring they provide better care.
We remain optimistic that the court is going to see these requirements for what they are, a sham designed to limit women's abortion access.
Jonathan Mitchell, what's at stake here? If there's a 4-4 decision, what happens? If there's a 5-3 decision, which way do you expect that may go?
Well, if it's a 4-4 decision, then there are two possible outcomes. One is for the Supreme Court to say that the Fifth Circuit judgment below is affirmed by an equally divided court. Now, if they were to say that, it would mean that the Fifth Circuit decision, which largely upheld these regulations, would remain in effect, but that would have no nationwide precedent. The other possible disposition, if there's a 4-4 tie, is for the Supreme Court to hold the case over for next term after the new justice gets confirmed. So they have a choice in the matter if it splits 4-4. If it goes 5-3 in either direction, then there would be a precedential holding that would either sustain the validity of the laws or strike them down. And there'd be an opinion of the court, if it's joined by five justices, that would establish a binding precedent going forward on lower federal courts and state courts when they review abortion regulations.
Anthony Kennedy saying yesterday maybe we need more evidence here. Is there another path where it just gets sent back down for more background?
That's possible based on the questions that he asked. Now, Justice Kennedy's certainly right to point out that there are holes in the factual record in this case. The plaintiffs did not introduce any evidence that the ambulatory surgical center requirement would actually cause clinics to close, because there's always the option that clinics could relocate into one of the 400 or more ambulatory surgical centers in the state of Texas. Another problem was that half the state's abortion clinics weren't even parties to this lawsuit, so there's no evidence in the record of what those clinics plan to do. So no one really knows what will happen with the ambulatory surgical center requirement, because the law has never taken effect. With the admitting privileges law, that law has been in effect for about 2 years now. And although there have been some clinics that have closed during that window, it's not clear from the record whether those clinics closed because of the admitting privileges requirement or for other reasons. We know, for example, that some clinics closed for reasons unrelated to House Bill 2. Sometimes the doctor retires or moves. Some clinics have closed because of cuts in the state's family planning budget. Some clinics closed before House Bill 2 even took effect. So the plaintiffs haven't proven with record evidence that House Bill 2 is causing the closures that they allege will happen or that have happened in the past.
But they closed en masse immediately upon the enaction of segments of this bill, right? I mean, you went from 40 to 20, and people are saying if this is affirmed, it'll go to 10 with, I'm reading here, something like 700,000 Texans more than 200 miles away from the nearest abortion clinic.
It's not quite accurate to say they closed en masse. There were closures that occurred before the law took effect. There were some closures that occurred immediately when the admitting privileges law took effect. Maybe 7 clinics closed on the day the admitting privileges law took effect. So one might think or infer that those clinics closed because of the admitting privileges law. But it's impossible to prove that the other clinics, which closed either before or after the admitting privileges law took effect, closed because of the admitting privileges law. So the plaintiffs bear the burden of proof, as they do in all civil litigation, and they need to show with record evidence, by a preponderance of the evidence, that those closures were caused by the admitting privileges law. So there are a lot of gaps in the record. The idea of sending it back to the trial court, which was what Justice Kennedy suggested, is unusual because usually a litigant only gets one shot to develop their factual case. Now, maybe if the court wants to allow the law to take effect first and see what happens with respect to ambulatory surgical centers, there may be a basis to find out after the law takes effect what the effects will actually be. But no one really knows.
Day one, the requirements took effect. 11 clinics shut down. Other requirements came into effect. Another dozen facilities closed. Emily, what were the questions that struck you from the justices yesterday in this case?
Well, Justice Kagan brought up the issue that you're talking about now, and she pointed out that in the two-week period that the surgical center requirement did go into effect, over a dozen facilities shut their doors. And then, she said, when that part of the law was stayed, when it was no longer in effect, it was lifted, the clinics reopened immediately. So she pointed out this is almost like the perfect controlled experiment as to the effect of the law. You put the law into effect, 12 clinics closed. You take the law out of effect, they reopen.
Jonathan Mitchell, did you personally, in your professional capacity, argue before the Fifth Circuit on this?
Yes, I argued the case before the Fifth Circuit about 2 years ago.
And did you assert to them that this was not about creating an obstacle to abortion facilities?
Of course.
Services?
Yeah, we argued that this was a law that was designed to protect patient safety and establish minimum standards of care for not only abortion patients, but also for fetuses. Patients and their fetuses have suffered grievous harms in other states at the hands of substandard abortion practitioners like Kermit Gosnell, David Benjamin in New York, Abu Hayat. There have been some people who have been practicing abortions that have no business practicing medicine. And the point of Texas's law is to make sure that not only the practitioners, but also the facilities in which abortions are offered meet certain minimum standards of safety and cleanliness and decency.
But, I mean, do you believe that that's really the honest reason for this? We see lots of abortion foes heavily pushing this. And, I mean, it looks like this is a way to just cut people off from abortion.
No, it's not the case. You look at other institutions like the National Abortion Federation and their 2000 Guide to Good Care. They specifically recommended that abortion patients should seek abortions only from doctors who hold admitting privileges at a local hospital. If you read the Kermit Gosnell grand jury report, the grand jury specifically recommended that states amend their laws to require all abortions to be performed in ambulatory surgical centers, with the goal of preventing another Kermit Gosnell-like practitioner from emerging. So these are laws that have support well beyond anti-abortion groups. They even have the support of organizations that support abortion rights, like the National Abortion Federation.
I mean, I'm reading the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Family Physicians, all saying this is unnecessary, maybe even dangerous in its own way, but we'll look at it. Jonathan Mitchell, please stand by in Stanford. Emily Bazelon in New Haven, Connecticut. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking about the Supreme Court missing a member and wading into abortion law. That is always a hot, hot subject outside the court yesterday. Anti-abortion and pro-abortion rights activists in full throat. Rights activists chanting, singing the works.
We must fight for freedom!
We must fight for freedom!
We must fight for justice!
We are looking at the High Court taking up the restrictive Texas abortion law that has seen clinic closures all over that state. Samantha Bee talked with Dan Flynn, one of the authors of the Texas law that justices will vote on. He talked Monday with her on her show Full Frontal.
We're not removing access to health care. We're improving.
So the intention of the law was not to do away with abortions.
No.
It was just to make them impossible to acquire.
You know better than that. What do you mean impossible? I'll tell you what, anytime you start cutting on people's body, you need to have it in a procedure where it can be healthy.
Of course. You don't cut a woman in an abortion, though.
There is that. You can join the conversation this hour. Do you see genuine concern for quality health care here? Do you see a thinly veiled drive to restrict abortion? Could the High Court open a door here to restrictions all over the country? How do you feel about a 4-4 court hearing this case? With Jonathan Mitchell, he was Solicitor General of the state of Texas from 2010 to 2015, represented Texas in the very case that has been argued before the Supreme Court this week, as well as some others that I hope we'll talk about. Emily Bazelon is with us, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, fellow at Yale Law School, with us today from New Haven, Connecticut. Emily, I wish you'd take us further into the texture of who's saying what as the court takes this case on board. What else did you hear yesterday of note?
Well, one of the arguments Texas makes is that because New Mexico has clinics near the border, women can just go over to New Mexico and that access abortion that way. And this was a moment that in which Justice Ginsburg said, well, if you need all of these heavy restrictions for the protection of women, New Mexico doesn't have those restrictions. So why is it okay if it's supposedly unsafe to send women across the border? I think that's another way of showing that what's really at stake here is not protecting the health and safety of women, much as it is appealing to abortion opponents to try to take that claim for themselves and that rhetoric. It just really doesn't hold up, as the American Medical Association and other groups have so clearly pointed out.
Take us back to 1992 and Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey, and the role of Justice Anthony Kennedy there, and the sort of description of undue burden that emerged from that case.
Well, Kennedy played a key role with then at the time Justice Souter and Justice O'Connor. There was this center of the court that preserved the core right to abortion in Roe versus Wade, but allowed the state to protect the health of the fetus, the life of the fetus, to a degree that up to the point of causing an undue burden on women's access to abortion. And one of the important distinctions that the justices made in Casey was between a necessary medical regulation that provided benefit that could help women make a more informed choice by letting them know about the development of the fetus, for example. Pennsylvania had a law like that at the time, versus an unnecessary medical regulation that was in place merely to cause an undue burden. And so the question for the court, given all the things we've been discussing, which kind of law did Texas pass?
So an undue burden, Kennedy co-wrote this 1992 opinion, those would include unnecessary health regulations that have the purpose or effect of presenting a substantial obstacle to a woman seeking an abortion. Jonathan Mitchell, are miles to a clinic, does that constitute a substantial burden, 200 miles, let's say?
Well, let me just clarify something Emily said earlier. The court never said in Casey that abortion regulations have to be medically necessary, and they specifically upheld a 24-hour waiting period that Pennsylvania had enacted, which did nothing at all to advance patient health or safety. All it did was make abortion access more difficult by requiring two trips to the clinic rather than one. So there are burdens that are
allowed to be imposed. Undue burden was the heart of the case.
Yeah, the test was undue burden, but the court never said that any law that's medically unnecessary is therefore an undue burden. And the courts also upheld laws that require physicians to perform abortions and forbid non-physicians to perform them, even though studies have shown that abortions can be performed by non-physicians without any risk to patient
health. How many miles would constitute, to your mind, an undue burden? 100, 200, 300, 600?
That's a good question, Tom. No one knows the answer to that question. All we can go on is what the Supreme Court has said. And the way they've defined undue burden, it's vague, it's very indeterminate, but they've said in the Casey decision that it's an undue burden if it imposes a substantial obstacle in the path of a patient seeking an abortion. So how bad does the obstacle have to be to qualify as substantial? We know from Casey that a 24-hour waiting period is not an undue burden. And a 24-hour waiting period doubles the driving distances because it requires two trips to the clinic rather than one.
So 200 miles would be 400 miles, potentially, or a hotel stay, motel stay overnight.
Exactly. I mean, the 24-hour waiting period clearly imposes costs on patients who are seeking the abortion by either increasing the driving distance or requiring a stay at a hotel. The Supreme Court said that's a burden, but it's not an undue burden. But where is exactly the tipping point? No one has any idea. And that's why you see such division on the Supreme Court, because liberal justices are inclined to think that any regulation of abortion qualifies as an undue burden. Conservative justices apply a more permissive version of the test. But it's a test that's just not in the Constitution. The court made it up, and people are inevitably falling back on their ideological priors when they try to apply a test like that.
Emily, what did you hear yesterday when it comes to this undue burden test and how the justices might be thinking about it?
Well, I think Jonathan's right that the test is subjective and tricky. I think to back up a step here, abortion is a very safe procedure. It has a really low rate of complication. Yes, things do go wrong, but to a much less frequent degree than lots of other common procedures that the state of Texas is not regulating with anything like these kinds of restrictions. So, for example, colonoscopies, a procedure we associate with men, 28 times riskier in terms of the mortality rate. No requirement that men have to go to ambulatory surgical centers to receive colonoscopies. And thinking about it this way, I think, helps show that abortion gets singled out. And that, I think, is what the liberal justices were trying to point out yesterday. It's not that any regulation of abortion is unconstitutional. It's that abortion exceptionalism treats medical regulations as a way of preventing abortion, making it harder to get, because the people who are passing the laws ideologically and morally oppose abortion.
What about Justice Kennedy? And did he show anything of his hand beyond asking, saying maybe we need more information here? I mean, he co-authored the Casey decision.
Well, he did seem concerned about some of the evidentiary gaps in the record that Jonathan was talking about earlier, had this idea of perhaps sending the case back to the lower courts. Again, you know, I think we can question whether it's really in doubt that clinics are closing as a result of this law, but he seemed to want to have more proof about that. And from his point of view, an 8-justice court, you can imagine that it would be attractive to try to punt and wait until there is a 9th justice to resolve this issue. That may be part of what he was thinking yesterday.
Jonathan, how would it have changed things, to your mind, if Antonin Scalia were still sitting on the court when they heard these arguments this week?
I think it would have been a more lively argument. There would have been some more questions asked from the bench. But I don't think Justice Scalia's absence will change the ultimate outcome in this case, because if Justice Scalia were on the court, I think he would very likely vote to uphold the laws. But if Justice Scalia is not there, it's either a 4-4 tie, which means the Fifth Circuit decision is affirmed, or if Justice Kennedy is inclined to strike the laws down, it only means that the state loses 5-3 rather than losing 5-4. So ultimately, his absence won't make a difference into whether the Texas laws are upheld or struck down.
Let's go to our listeners who are listening very closely on this case. Austin, Texas, calling in. Megan. Hi, Megan. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I actually worked for one of the few remaining abortion facilities in the state of Texas during the time that these laws were coming into and out of effect.
Okay.
And my points regarding the admitting privileges requirements. Well, most hospitals require physicians to maintain a certain patient quota. And as it's been pointed out, this is an extremely safe procedure, so safe that in over a year that I worked for this clinic, not a single patient was ever admitted to the hospital, making it really difficult for physicians to maintain these relationships with the hospitals.
So what is the impact on abortion clinics like yours and others? I mean, you're in a major metropolitan area. I don't know, maybe some of your clinics can afford it, but we've seen so many close.
Indeed, Tom, you're absolutely right. And I think that the impact of this particular requirement would be that if a physician fails to maintain these admitting privileges because the procedures that they're performing daily are so safe that they are not admitting patients to the hospitals and they run the risk of losing those privileges, the clinic would lose its provider and it would close, and patients would have to go even further away to get this procedure.
So you work there. Do you see this as being about patient safety or about shutting down access, creating a burden when it comes to getting an abortion?
I can speak that the patients that I've interacted with, they don't see it as being about their health or their protection. They certainly are viewing it as a burden. So just to give them a voice in this, they are of the opinion that this is certainly making it much more difficult for them to obtain this extremely safe and legal procedure.
Megan, I appreciate your call from Austin, Texas. One more right here from Franklin, Tennessee. Dale, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Dale.
Hi, thank you. I find it really kind of shamefully revealing that those who sort of tend to be politically on the right and who normally rail against regulations of any and all kind have no problem with imposing regulations on women. And I think it's I'm amazed that they could look me straight in the eye and not being, you know, disingenuous, if not downright dishonest, by claiming that, oh, no, this has nothing to do with women's rights. And by the way, they talk about a 24-hour waiting period.
Yes.
With gun rights, they don't even allow that for somebody to buy a gun to hurt somebody But for women's rights, I just think it's such a sham, and I hope that the court sees right through it, as they should.
Dale, I appreciate your call. Jonathan, a call from Texas saying this is creating a real burden, and you hear Dale saying, how do people assert this with a straight face? I mean, you've got all these medical groups saying that neither of these requirements is, quoting here, supported by accepted medical practice or scientific evidence.
Yeah, well, one has to read the Kermit-Gosnell grand jury report to get an appreciation for the context of why Texas and other states are enacting these laws. Unregulated abortion, when states just decide to take a hands-off approach and allow abortion providers to self-regulate, opens the door for substandard practitioners like Gosnell and others to enter the profession and inflict grievous harms on their patients.
But why impose regulations that make it so difficult for these services to be available when they're constitutionally, covered?
Well, constitutionally covered. I'm not sure what you mean by that. The Supreme Court has said in
Roe v. Wade, there's a constitutional right to abortion.
That's different from saying it's constitutionally covered. It's a Supreme Court opinion that declares that states can't regulate the procedure or ban the procedure. But that's different from saying that the Constitution protects that right. It's a Supreme Court decision purporting to apply the Constitution. But to get back to your point about whether we should have these regulations or whether they're justified, the Kermit-Gosnell grand jury report specifically says the state should require abortions to be performed in licensed ambulatory surgical centers to prevent a repeat of the episode in Pennsylvania. Because what happened in Pennsylvania, Kermit-Gosnell had been violating all sorts of abortion laws for 20 years, and the state regulatory authorities did nothing to stop him. It's a problem many states have because you will have laws on the books that often go unenforced because state regulatory authorities or individuals in the state government aren't willing to bring charges or enforcement actions against abortion providers or other entities that they regulate. The idea behind the admitting privileges law is to bring hospital admitting privileges committees in to provide oversight and accountability for abortion providers that state regulators may not be trusted to provide. And the report goes into detail about how the Pennsylvania regulatory authorities had failed for over 20 years in allowing Gosnell to operate when there were many warning signs and many complaints filed, and they did nothing in response to that.
Emily, this seems like it can go round and round. You've got these medical groups saying not necessary, no evidence that it's necessary. Jonathan and others will cite the Kermit-Gosnell report and, their fact set. How does the court end up deciding something like this?
I don't think it really does go round and round. You know, Pennsylvania had not inspected Kermit-Gosnell's clinic for 7 years. There were existing regulations on the book in Pennsylvania and in Texas that would have prevented some of the horrible things that happened at that clinic. That man really did harm women. Enforcing existing laws is a different remedy than passing a new set of regulations that go much further and aren't about inspections and don't have the same kind of medical justification behind that. I think, you can see a difference there.
Jean in Ashland, Wisconsin. Jean, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I maintain that nobody has a right to kill anybody at all, any time, any place, for any reason, from conception to natural death. Where do we get the idea that we should kill other people?
I mean, we have settled constitutional law from the United States Supreme Court that in 1973 said there's a right to abortion. So you disagree, but what about the highest court in the land?
There's a lot of wrong laws, and that happens to be a very wrong law. We don't have a right. The Supreme Court doesn't have a right to give anybody a right to kill anybody.
Gene, we've got it. Let me get one more. Brad in Essex, Iowa. Brad, you're on.
Yeah, kind of the opposite of what Gene was saying is the value. Where is the value of settled law? You have to be able to rely on a decision to be something more than the decision until the next election. This isn't politics. This is law. And law should be settled or it has no value.
What about, do you see room here to debate what constitutes an undue burden, even under settled law, Brad?
Oh, there's room for debate, absolutely. But what I hear more is that people want to use the debate function to unsettle the law and try and peel back Roe v. Wade. And whether you agree with it or not, like your other caller, it is the settled law of the land, and therefore that has value and meaning.
Brad, I appreciate your call as well. Emily, are we in that terrain here where the court could decide in such a way that it effectively undercut Roe v. Wade itself.
Yes, I think the idea of turning access to abortion into an empty right, where theoretically women have that right, but in fact it gets so difficult to access it that it doesn't really exist, that is what is on the table here in one form. If this kind of restriction is upheld, you can imagine the next restriction. You can imagine even fewer abortion clinics. And let's remember that when we diminish access in that way, we hurt poor women. Those are the people for whom these long distances of travel and the extra expense and figuring out what to do with your kids, your family while you're gone, those are the people for whom this truly is a burden. Well, I also want to say I appreciate the honesty of Jean, the caller who said she just opposes abortion because she thinks life begins at conception. That is a morally and intellectually honest discussion of the issue.
Point taken. Whether that's what we're having before the Supreme Court, debated in some quarters right now. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the U.S. Supreme Court missing a member and wading into abortion law, the High Court taking up the restrictive Texas abortion law that has seen clinic closures all over that state. You can join us this hour. How do you feel about a 4-4, perhaps, court hearing this case? Is this another case that makes clear just how important, how consequential that ninth seat is? And are you on board with waiting a year longer for the next president to fill that ninth seat on the High Court? Emily Bazelon is with us, writes for the New York Times Magazine, fellow at Yale Law School. Jonathan Mitchell is here from Stanford, California, and Stanford Law School right now. He was a law clerk for Justice Antonin Scalia and was Solicitor General of the state of Texas 2010 to 2015 when this abortion case was being argued, then before the Fifth Circuit and more. Now it's being argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. Jonathan, Emily, lots of callers for the two of you. Shauna in Austin, Texas. Shauna, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling because I am one of the victims of this law, and I know that we cannot wait another year for it. This past July, I was pregnant, and I was about 17, 18 weeks pregnant when my water broke, and it was absolutely devastating to me, but they told me there was no chance of survival for the baby, and I had a condition called placenta previa, which meant that at any point, if I went into labor, the potential of me bleeding to death was very huge.
Okay.
And I had a 4-year-old daughter. So there was really no question in my mind that I needed to get an abortion because I needed to make sure that I stayed alive.
But how did the law affect you, Shauna? You were in Austin, Texas. I assume there are clinics there.
You would assume so, right? And there are. However, they were not allowed. In order for me to go into a hospital, they wanted an ethics committee to meet. They told me that ethics committee could not meet for at least a week, which would have put me in about 2 more weeks of waiting to see if they decided that I was going to be able to have the procedure or not. I couldn't wait 2 weeks because I could have started bleeding at any point. So my only option was to go to Planned Parenthood. And I love Planned Parenthood, but it wasn't the right place for me at that time. I was too far along. I had to go in one day, have dilators put in, go home, wait overnight, go back again the next day for the procedure. And it was the most horrific and traumatic experience of my life. I could hear everything. I could feel everything. And it's because of the laws in Texas that I wasn't allowed to have adequate medical care in a situation where my life was on the line.
I'm sorry you had to go through that. It's not clear to me that these particular this particular law being argued before the Supreme Court is the one in effect. The ethics panel, for example. Stand by, Shauna. Jonathan, this is clearly serious. Shauna's life potentially on the line. Is the ethics review part of what the Supreme Court's looking at?
No. There's no law in Texas that requires an ethics review by a hospital committee.
Well, she ran up against something there that delayed her treatment.
Yeah. I mean, hospitals are very reluctant to do abortions as a general matter, but that has nothing to do with the law. They just don't do them.
And Shauna, you felt as though you were fighting for your life in a way.
Absolutely. And the last thing I wanted was to have to hear my baby being taken out of my body, and that's what I had to hear. And if these laws weren't so restrictive, there would have been a lot more options for me at that time.
Shauna, I'm sorry you had to go through that. I appreciate your call. One more right here. Pamela in Concord, Massachusetts. Pamela, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just have a question for Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
If this law is, in fact, to protect the health and safety of the mother and child, why are not birthing centers included. Giving birth is far more dangerous than having an abortion.
Jonathan Mitchell.
We haven't had Kermit Gosnells practicing at birthing centers. I mean, it's unfortunate but true, the abortion industry has attracted some unsavory characters and some disreputable physicians who've grievously harmed their patients.
But Pam's right, that giving birth is just factually more dangerous than abortion.
It's not clear that's right, even as a factual matter, because there are every reason to believe that complications from abortions are underreported. When people say that abortion's extremely safe, they're going on the complications that actually have been reported to state medical authorities. But many people don't report complications.
Pamela, how do you feel about the cases before the high court right now?
Birth.
Sorry, we didn't hear you, Pamela.
Even if you double, triple, quadruple the underreported dangers of having an abortion, it's still less dangerous than giving birth.
What does that leave you?
Giving birth is clearly more dangerous.
So what does that leave you thinking?
Any restriction for the health of the mother should include birth itself. And if it doesn't, that's a clear indication that the laws are meant to stop abortions, not help the health of the mother and child.
Pamela, I appreciate your call. Emily, I want to come back to Justice Kennedy because he appears to be the swing, if there is a swing right now on this. Take us into what he said, how he thinks, what's being presented right here. Can you give us any further insight into where he may go?
You know, one of the reasons that these laws are crafted in the way that they are is that the last time there was a major abortion case before the Supreme Court, Justice Kennedy wrote a line in his opinion about how some women come to regret their abortions. This is true. Some women are grateful for them, but some do regret them. And then he said that because of his concern for those women, it was okay to ban a whole particular kind of late-term procedure rather than inform women about it. He was essentially protecting women from knowledge, even if that meant banning a particular rare late-term kind of abortion. If Justice Kennedy kind of hangs on to that paternalist approach to women, then perhaps he can imagine a way to justify a law like this that has no medical basis but purports to protect women. The state makes that claim. But I think what's important about the kinds of points that Pamela, our caller, was just making is that you see abortion being treated in a way that is different from every other medical procedure that is not related to relative risk. It is related to the moral and ideological objections people have about abortion. And so it is being singled out. And really all of the rhetoric comes down to this question of, do states have a responsibility given a constitutional right to abortion to regulate in a way that has a rational relationship with risk? Or can they just create whatever requirements they choose in order really to create barriers?
Can we begin to bring this around to the very large issue of the fact that it's an 8-person court at the moment, an 8-justice court? Given that, Jonathan, how important first of all, I guess there's this. If President Obama were to put up a nominee and the Senate were to get busy with that, would that nominee be in a seat on the court in time to affect this case?
I don't think the nominee would be able to vote on this case because the nominee has not sat through the oral arguments or voted at conference. So it's unlikely they would confirm a nominee before the end of the Supreme Court's term, which ends on July 1st or around that time. So most likely, if there's a nominee confirmed, that nominee will be seated for the court's next term beginning in October.
We may have, Emily, a 4-4 decision or some sending this back to the Fifth Circuit that would flip this over into the court's future consideration. I guess it's plain as can be, but just speak to how the selection of that next justice could affect this case and abortion rights more broadly.
Well, you see how crucial the identity of that person is for a case like this, because he or she could well be the deciding vote in this case and many others. You know, look, the Supreme Court decides lots of cases that are not by slim 5-4 majorities, that are much more that have much more capacity to be resolved by just looking at a statute and reading the interpretation. They're not necessarily ideological. And then there are a handful or, you know, several cases every year that are deeply contested, where people have strong moral and ideological positions on either side. And it becomes at that point impossible to separate the court from people's beliefs, people's moral beliefs, people's political predisposition.
There's been a lot of talk about the public perceiving the court as highly politicized. We certainly saw a lot of political energy outside the court yesterday. I mean, abortion's been hot for a long time. But do you see, Emily, the political maneuvering over the nomination and the process to get the next justice on that court as heightening a public sense of this being just an extension of politics rather than something above and beyond?
I think there's an escalation right now in the Republican Senate leadership refusing to hold a hearing or perhaps even meet with a potential nominee. And it's an escalation of an approach to confirmation that began years ago when Democrats rejected Robert Bork, who they thought was ideologically extreme. That was like the kind of first step along the march that we've been on ever since, where we have these very politicized, partisan, increasingly battles over Supreme Court nominations. And, you know, we're seeing another step along the way. And it was interesting this morning, there was a poll that I think 2/3 of Americans think that this nominee should get hearing. And I think the Republican Senate's approach to even disregard or say that itself can't happen is, taking the process changing the process or refusing to have the process happen at all in a way that is new.
Abortion front and center this week, but there are some other big cases that the court is to look at on affirmative action, immigration, affordable care. Give us just a sense of the stakes in each of those.
Well, the immigration case, which will probably be argued toward the end of April, is a big case about President Obama's plan to potentially provide relief from deportation to the families of lots of Dreamers, meaning kids who came to the United States from other countries as children. And that is a big case about the president's executive authority. Usually we think of the president and the presidency as this court has said in the past that because immigration policy has to be national, you're dealing with other sovereign states, the president has a lot of leeway. But Texas is saying in this case that the president's plans impose a burden on Texas. They're going to have to grant driver's licenses to lots of people who get legal residency, and that Texas' argument is that gives it standing to sue and to try to block this law from going into effect. So that is a big one to be looking out for.
Jonathan Mitchell, you were involved in arguing or representing Texas on that case as well as Solicitor General. Does Antonin Scalia's death put the Texas position in trouble on this immigration question around executive action?
Well, it's a similar situation in the abortion case where Texas won below in the Fifth Circuit. So without Justice Scalia, if there's a 4-4 split, the Fifth Circuit decision would be affirmed by an equally divided court or perhaps held over for re-argument next term. So I don't think Justice Scalia's absence will change the outcome here. It will, however, I think, prevent Texas from winning a 5-4 majority precedential decision at the Supreme Court.
Emily Bazelon on affirmative action. This goes back to Texas yet again, and Justice Scalia was quite key here. Remind us the stakes in the case there.
Right. This is a case called Fisher versus University of Texas. It's about the affirmative action program at UT. Most of the students admitted to University of Texas come in because they do really, really well in high school. Texas has what's called a top 10% plan, where a top certain percentage of high school graduates get in. But they have reserved a small number of spots for what they call a more holistic approach to admissions, where they can look at lots of different factors, where you grew up, how much hardship, what kind of extracurriculars, all that kind of stuff. And one of the factors mixed up in that soup is race. And the question in this case, which the court has heard before, is whether University of Texas is using race in a way that's impermissible. the lower court, in this case, the same old Fifth Circuit we keep talking about, ruled in favor of the University of Texas, saying that its approach to affirmative action was constitutionally permissible. It looked like when the Supreme Court decided to hear this case, they must be unhappy with that result, because why else would they have chosen to take this case back? Without Justice Scalia, however, as Jonathan has made the point, in other cases, there is no longer a 5-4 majority for a decision that would have national precedential value. So that case becomes smaller, probably, unless there is a 5-3 majority in favor of a kind of broad pro-affirmative action ruling, which seems kind of unlikely.
Jonathan? Justice Kagan's recused from this case. So,
oh, right. Good point. I forgot
so
that.
So it, yes, it would be 4-3. There won't be a 4-4 split here.
So does Scalia's absence make a significant difference in the potential outcome of this case on affirmative action, Fisher versus?
I don't think it makes any difference. It's up to Justice Kennedy, as usual.
It must be very obvious to you, as somebody who has argued these cases as they headed for the Supreme Court, what an enormous deal it is. Who fills that next seat? Do you have a position on that, whether the court should just go ahead and get its next nominee, or whether they should wait, as the Republicans now say, for the presidential election to be completed, Jonathan?
Well, the Constitution gives the president the power to nominate and the Senate the power to withhold its consent. So it's really up to the president and the Senate. I think it's very hard right now for them to find any nominee who's acceptable both to President Obama and also to the Republicans in the Senate. It's going forward. We've been seeing Supreme Court nominees in the past are now being confirmed basically on party line votes. It's going to be very tough, I think, for any future president to get a nominee through the Senate when the Senate's controlled by the opposite party.
And yet we have to have a 9-person Supreme Court, Emily. And here we are with all these big cases lined up and a year plus before us if there is no nominee.
Well, we don't actually have to have a 9-member Supreme Court. As Jonathan just reminded us, we could have 7 justices deciding a major issue, affirmative action. And if the scenario we've been talking about, or Jonathan just mentioned, comes to pass, and a party needs to control the presidency and the Senate to get any nominee through, that's like a new ball game in the Supreme Court. That would mean that you could have multiple vacancies for years before new people got confirmed. It would really change the way we think about the composition of the Supreme Court, and our assumption of 9 justices could turn out to have been a mere convention. It's not written down anywhere that the court has to have a full complement all the time.
I'm kind of staggered by that. Is there any precedent in history for the court going down from its accepted number and just staying there?
Well, there
Andrew
were
Johnson's
a couple of
precedent. Yeah.
Yes, Andrew Johnson couldn't get anyone through, right?
Right. Wow. And so we could be in a whole new terrain where it's just okay, we've got a new number. Are you just blue skying there, Emily? Or do you imagine that could become a new norm?
Oh, I'm not blue skying. I think it's a real possibility. There are these moments of realignment. It happened with Franklin Roosevelt, too, where the court becomes so politicized that the way we think about it changes. And we're on the cusp of that right now.
On the cusp of a lot here on abortion, on immigration, and right on down the list. Grateful to the two of you for looking into it with us. Jonathan Mitchell, former Solicitor General of Texas, now at Stanford Law School. Thank you very much, Jonathan Mitchell, for being with us.
Thank you.
And Emily Bazelon, staff writer with the New York Times Magazine, fellow at the Yale Law School, joining us today from New Haven, Connecticut. Emily, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.